Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, philanthropist and billionaire four times over, David Rubenstein is going to join us, talk about his book and many interviews. We have the news coming as well. First, there's Jordan Harbinger. The Jordan Harbinger Show, a different kind of sponsor for this episode, the Jordan Harbinger Show. Well, if you're a fan of fascinating podcasts and interesting people, you should definitely check this one out. There's an episode for everyone, no matter what you're into. Jordan talks with Scott Adams about persuasion in a world where facts don't matter anymore. Man, is he right. Or you go inside the dark world of wildlife trafficking. You'll always find something useful to apply to your own life, like routine changes to boost productivity or slight mindset tweaks to change how you see the world. Jordan's a good guy. We've had him on many times. I know the man well, and he's worth a listen. We enjoy the show, and we know you will, too. So you can search The Jordan Harbinger Show. That is H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts.
And now, from the cutting room floor of the 2021 ACE Awards, for Invention of the Year, Sexbot Innovations continued.
Okay, you've created this incredible, lifelike, animated piece of technology that guys can have sex with. But what you need to do is also give them another skill so we have plausible deniability. Yep. So make them a sex bot who can also push a lawnmower.
Right.
Or something. And then when the wife finds it in the garage, we go, "Puff, you nuts? I got her to fucking mow the lawn so you wouldn't have to."
"Well, honey, why is there jizz coming out of my lawnmower bot?" You'd say to your wife.
Join us in 11 and a half months for the 2022 ACE Awards.
David Rubenstein has joined us, co-founder of the Carlyle Group, philanthropist, author. He's got a book. It's available on Amazon as we speak, called The American Experiment, Dialogues on a Dream. Good to see you, David.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, you speak to a lot of really interesting people. And and we were playing your interview with Dr. Fauci a little bit earlier in the show as well, and that then kind of made the rounds semi-recently because of your exchange and some of his thoughts on exercise and masks and things like that. But what made you want to interview Fauci in the first place? This is pre-pandemic.
Dr. Fauci is somebody I've known for a long time, well before the pandemic. He's been a friend of mine and somebody I've admired. He's been honored by several presidents for his things before the pandemic ever came along. So I interviewed him before the pandemic, and then I updated it when the pandemic came to kind of make the interview more relevant.
And for you, I mean, you talked to Madeleine Albright, you talked to Ken Burns, you talked to Billie Jean King and Rita Moreno, Paul Simon, Wynton Marsalis. I mean, for you, is there a criteria, or they just have to be interesting?
Well, it usually helps if I know them, because I find generally interviews, it's easier to get people to agree to do an interview with you if you know them in some way, shape, or form. Secondly, I generally look for people I think will be good at giving an interview. Sometimes people are famous, you might know them, but as you know from doing this yourself, sometimes people are just very close-lipped and they don't want to say anything. So I'm always looking for people that are kind of willing to open up, in my judgment. And then I was looking for a cross-section of prominent Americans so I could make the points I wanted about my book.
I bring it up every other show, but it's incredible that we're going to have this digital archive of all of these Americans and our humans giving long-form interviews. And in a weird way, it's like they'll never go away. You know, I mean, we can pontificate about what the voice of the founding fathers would have sounded like, and you can read their texts and documents and things, but could you imagine just long form interviews with all these people we grew up just seeing in our history books. It's sort of that way from this day forward.
Yes, you're correct. I mean, I wish there were interviews of people like Julius Caesar or Charlemagne or Henry VIII or Napoleon or Shakespeare. We don't have that. The interview format didn't really exist back then. We now have it, and now we're overdosing on interviews because, as you probably know, everybody seems to be an interviewer these days. Everybody has a podcast. Everybody has a TV show. Everybody's on YouTube. So it may be 100 years from now, people will think that nobody did anything at our time other than do interviews.
Yeah. And I was also saying that instead of removing all the Civil War generals and their horses, like all the statues, and I think Teddy Roosevelt more recently, they took his statue. I was saying leave the horses.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like take the person. And then this would be an era where all we had is interviews and statues of horses. That's essentially what future civilizations would say about us during this time.
It could be the case.
I know you did the pledge, I think, with Warren Buffett and Bill Gates.
Right.
Can you explain how that works?
Sure. This was an idea that Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and Melinda Gates had, essentially that people that have a net worth of, let's say, roughly $1 billion would commit to give away during their lifetime or upon their death half of their net worth. So there were 40 of us who signed initially. Now there's probably about 200 of us. It's not really designed to change the world in a dramatic way because there aren't, 200 people aren't enough. It was really designed, in my view, to promote the idea of philanthropy for everybody. Because you don't need to be a billionaire to give away money. Anybody can give away money. And I wanted to make it clear, at least in my own case, that it's a good thing to give away money to causes you think are good and make the world slightly better. If you have money, and I like to remind people that philanthropy doesn't mean just giving away money. Give away your time, your energy, and ideas. That can be just as valuable.
Yeah, 100%. And most people I have spoken to that are, have some worth and some knowledge and some experience are always pretty happy about sharing that with other people, usually flattered. I have found, and obviously it makes the biggest impact in your life when you're exposed to those people. A mentorship program, something like that, it seemed like a really important, I mean, I know it exists. I was a Catholic big brother back in the day. It was important to my young Catholic little brother, but I feel like we do talk a lot about donating, but we don't talk as much about mentorship as we should.
Well, listen, the word philanthropy is derived from an ancient Greek word that means loving humanity. It doesn't mean rich people writing checks. We kind of bastardized the term by listing philanthropists by how much money they gave away as opposed to how much time or how much mentoring they did. And clearly, the most enjoyable thing I've done in my philanthropy is scholarships or other kinds of things I've done to help young people, because you feel like that's the future and they probably appreciate it much more than anybody else when you're actually helping them in some way or form or another.
You get any pushback from your kids when you were talking about giving away half your fortune?
No, because I told my kids from the beginning, I'm going to do the best I can to give you a good education. And, I started with no money and, you'll have a better education than I had. And, in the end, you'll be happier.
And that's also, I believe, Warren Buffett's philosophy, correct?
Warren Buffett initially pledged to give none of his children any money. Ultimately, his wife, Susie, his first wife, did give some money to them. But Warren didn't really give any of them children money. That was his view.
Do you, you're familiar with Brian Grazer? I mean, you're familiar, yes, with him. Do you know him?
I've met him a few times. I've been at various conferences with him, but I wouldn't say he's a friend of mine.
Bad blood. I interviewed, let's start a Twitter feud. I interviewed him and it reminded me of you and that he was just curious and he wanted to talk to people and interview people and talk to people that he was curious about. And it was really the key to his success was really about just picking the brains of people that he thought were interesting. I've told the story before, but I mysteriously got called into his office many years ago to sit down to what I thought was some talk about a movie project. And he just talked to me for about an hour. And then I left and I never heard anything ever again. And it always it always vexed me. And then about 10 years later, he came on my show and he said, no, I just heard you on the radio. I thought you were interesting. So I just wanted to talk to you, which I was flattered by, but it still had to go to Century City to do it.
He never called me to interview me. So you're one up on me.
Well, I'm sure after he listens to this, you'll get into his queue. But is that in a way what you do? Find people that you think are interesting and speak to them?
Yes. Look, everybody has a story, and not everybody is really good at talking about it, but everybody has a story. The trick is to find some people who have interesting stories, have done something interesting, and are willing to talk about it and open up about themselves. And I think the appeal of it is that everybody wants to know how other people did what they did, how they got to be successful, how they got to be famous, wealthy, whatever it might be. People are interested in that. And so if you can get a good interview, it might inspire younger people to kind of use this interview as a bit of a role model. It might inspire other people to learn more. It's a good thing. It's a good form of communication. And I think the fact that so many people have podcasts and television shows today, interview shows, reflects the fact that people enjoy interviews. For example, if you look at the book, which you have done, you'll see basically I'm writing, I have the interview transcripts in there, edited a bit. But basically, people like reading the transcripts because, it's easier than reading War and Peace.
Interviewing is a difficult yet invisible skill that you can only really get from doing reps, essentially. I've felt it in my own career. Oh. Did you feel yourself on shaky ground at the beginning? Did you get much better? Were you much better after your 20th interview than you were on your first?
Like anything in life, if you do it for a while, you're probably going to get better at it. Despite that principle, my tennis game is not any better than it has been. It should have been. But anyway, I've been playing for 25 years. I still can't play very well. But generally, you get to be better. Now, when I started, I was just interviewing people at the Economic Club of Washington when I became the chairman of it. And I was supposed to bring in people to speak, but I realized most of the speakers were terrible. So I just stopped letting them speak, and I would interview them, and people seemed to like it. Then they put it on Bloomberg, and now I have a skill that some people, want me to come interview them or want me to do a guest interview. And so it's interesting. It's, many people, to my surprise, I've been in the business world for 30 years. And when I walk on down the street, you may have the same phenomenon. People come up to me and they know they want a selfie or they want to talk to me because of my interviewing. They've seen my interview and they don't know what I'm in the business world, right? They don't know what I've done before I did interviewing. And some people think I'm only an interviewer. So it's interesting how when you have a podcast or a television show or YouTube, people all of a sudden think that that's your full-time job and that's all you do. And to my view, the trick in being a good interviewer is prepare, make sure you know what you're talking about, which is the opposite of the Larry King style, but that's my view, is you're better off if you actually prepare. And secondly, sublimate your ego. Let the other person do the talking. I've seen some interviewers, and you may know some of them, where they over-talk the interviewee. They try to show the interviewee how much smarter they are than the interviewee, how much more they know. And in the end, the interviewee is kind of left to be insignificant in the conversation. And I try to avoid letting that happen.
Interesting story. Glad you asked, Dave.
Let there be a warning to you. Never do that.
Sit back and enjoy this this story. What I think you're very right. What happens at the beginning, I think, is it's a kind of a first date syndrome. You have a little bit of adrenaline. You don't want any air in it at all. And you end up forcing it a little, talking a little too much. Like I said, it's that sort of first date where you end up pushing a little too hard. And of course, the product, whether it's the date or the interview, isn't what you'd want it to be. So, but I feel like it takes some experience to sit back and let there be a little dead air in there on occasion, or let the other person really, really go on for a while. But I mean, you probably, your former attorney, right, or current attorney.
Right, correct.
And all the business, I mean, for you, you've always had to be able to communicate with intelligent people. That's business, right?
Well, yes. Look, I was a better talker than I was a scientist. If I was a good scientist, I would have majored in chemistry or something. But I thought my skill set was to be a lawyer, go into government and politics where talking helps. But it turned out that I wasn't that successful in government. So I ultimately went into business. where they are talking helps. You got to persuade people to buy your product or buy your investment or come work for you. So yeah, learning how to communicate is very important. In fact, you know, learning how to influence people is what the key to leadership is all about. If you're going to be a leader, you want to be a leader in anything, you have to have the ability to convince people to listen to you or to follow you.
So what? How did your career start off, or how did you start off?
I came from a blue-collar background. My parents did not graduate from high school. I was their only child. I had to get scholarships. I got a scholarship to Duke University. Not a basketball scholarship, I assure you. And then a scholarship to the University of Chicago Law School. Then I practiced law at Paul Weiss, which is a large firm in New York, where I worked for Ted Sorensen and had worked for John Kennedy. I got a job at the White House working for President Carter for 4 years. And then I went back and practiced law. I wasn't that good at it. So I started my private equity firm about 35 years ago, and it grew to be one of the largest in the world. And now I spend a large part of my time on nonprofit things. So I'm the chairman of the National Gallery of Art. I'm the chairman of the Kennedy Center. I was the chairman of the Smithsonian, chairman of the Library of Congress, things like that. And I was the chairman of my alma mater, Duke University, and, you know, I'll do things like that.
I was listening. It was interesting. Maybe we have that clip. Your Jimmy Carter reminded me of it. I was watching a documentary. I think they re-aired it. I think it was called Jimmy Carter, Rock and Roll President, or some version of
that. That's right. That's right.
It's an interesting documentary. But it struck me when he was giving a speech, it sounded like it was from 10 minutes ago. Like it's almost, 40 some odd years ago. But the dialogue and the tone felt like Joe Biden giving a speech. And it's from the Democratic National Convention. And it struck me. And so I told producer Chris, to pull it. And I don't know how – I'm just going to play you about 30 or 40 seconds of it, but I thought it was interesting.
Our nation has seen a failure of leadership. We've been hurt, and we've been disillusioned. We've seen a wall go up that separates us from our own government. We've lost some precious things that historically have bound our people and our government together. It's now time for healing. We want to have faith again. We want to be proud again. We just want the truth again. It's time for the people to run the government and not the other way around.
Now, if Joe Biden said those exact words a year ago, it would have just been,
would have landed.
Yeah. And then it made, first I found it interesting, then I found it depressing. Because I was like, really?
A rat?
Was from 1980.
That was, a speech that...
why Earth, Wind, and Fire was playing in that speech, but...
It was from that documentary.
Oh, it was from the doc.
Carter made a speech that was very famous, now known as the malaise speech, although he never used the phrase malaise, where he basically was saying the American people were in a bit of a malaise, in effect. And that was criticized heavily, and it really hurt his popularity going forward. President Carter, for all of his virtues, was not a great public speaker, as he would say. John Kennedy was somebody that knew how to give a great public speech. Ronald Reagan knew how to give a great public speech. Jimmy Carter wasn't as comfortable doing that as Reagan was or as Kennedy was. He also had a high-pitched voice, and he had a southern accent that grated on northern ears. So if you had a high-pitched voice, a southern accent, and you're saying things that a lot of people don't want to hear, you know, it didn't work out so well.
Yeah. So where do you think this thing is heading politically? What are your thoughts about the country, and what might we do?
Well, the country, it has some economic challenges. Obviously, the country is divided down the middle politically. We've lived through the Civil War. We've lived through the Vietnam period. We will live through this. I wish there was more bipartisanship in Washington. There isn't really any now. It used to be a good legislator was somebody that could get the other side to work with them. Now, the other side, the two sides just don't work together. I think the biggest worry I have right now is that the economy, while it's in pretty good shape, it's not perfect, and we have some probably air that'll come out of the bubble, because when interest rates go up, I think the economy will probably slow down a bit. I also think that the division in Washington is so intense that people are only focused on elections and only focused on political victory. So that's not such a great thing. But in the end, the country's going to be around 100 years from now, 200 years from now, and you know, I don't think the country's going away.
I always, I find it fascinating that we'll have more and more, but certainly now, you know, the right and the left, they're very different. Mm. And yet the country split pretty much right down the middle, which is I'm amazed that, you know, most elections are like 51, 49 or 50.6, you know, 49.2 or whatever. I'm always like, it would seem statistically impossible to take 330 million people and split them. You know, like you couldn't do it with a sports franchise or a detergent or an automobile. It would be crazed if it was like Audi and Ford right down the middle. Half the country loves Audi, other half loves Ford. It's bizarre that it's that close.
Yes, and with the country so split so closely, like evenly, wouldn't it make sense for a car company or a political candidate to run as sort of a centrist to be like, hey, we're here for everyone and scoop up all those people that are pliable towards the middle?
Well, Andrew Yang.
That's what Joe Biden did.
Indeed.
Yeah. And as we've seen in the Bruce Springsteen Super Bowl commercial, that's the only thing the right and the left can agree on is they both hate the center, apparently.
Uh-huh.
It's still
the way that the political system now is designed to make people enable people to raise money. The key to politics and success, many people believe, is raising a lot of money. You raise money not by being down the center, but by being on the far left or the far right. And members of Congress are raising money about 50% of the time because they just want to make sure they have a big war chest. So it's gotten to the point where you can raise a lot of money if you're on the far left or the far right. But if you're down the center, it's hard to raise money.
Well,
can I ask the guy who knows finances, can you explain how worried we should be, if at all, about inflation? And of course, there's people who want you to believe it's evil, and then some people are like, yeah, it's part of the economy. Where should we, what should we feel about that?
Okay. All right. When I worked in the White House, I managed to get inflation to 15%. So compared to the Carter years, this is nothing.
Okay.
But I would say that if you went to college and you took a standard book on course on economics, what they would have said 10, 15, 20 years ago is that 3% or 4% inflation is normal. But in the last 25 years, their inflation rate in the United States has been 2% or less. So when you have getting used to 2% or less, when you're at 3% or 3.5% where we are now, it seems high. It is high, and it's high because the supply chain problems have been a big factor. COVID is a big factor. Those are some of the factors. I think it'll normalize out in a year or so at probably closer to 3% or 2.5%, but it's not going to go out to 6 or 7% on a normal basis, in my view.
Okay. Thank you.
How do you feel about money? I feel...
Take it question.
Away. I was poor my whole life, and now I'm not. And I always tell people it's really not thinking about money so much that's the best part about having money. It's not counting your money or buying a yacht. It's just, it's not, you get a parking ticket and you're not destroyed. You know, I mean, think about what a parking ticket used to mean in terms of your bottom line when you were poor. It was like, oh, weak, ruined parking ticket. The good part about having money is you get a parking ticket and you throw it on your dashboard and drive away. You don't really think that much about it. That seems to be the number one perk, but you got a lot more money than I do, David. What's your philosophy?
I came from circumstances that are probably more modest than yours. So I had no money for a large part of my life. And now I have a fair amount of money by normal human standards, an enormous amount. I can't tell you that it makes me happier than to be wealthier than poor. I just feel I have more freedom. So there's no doubt that you can do more in life and you don't have to worry about money all the time. But some of the most unhappy people I know are the richest people I know.
Good.
And it gets to the point where you know, people get the feeling if they have $1 billion, they need $5 billion. They have $5 billion, they need $10 billion. They have $10 billion, they need $20 billion. These are tortured souls sometimes. The happiest people are often people who are not that wealthy. They don't care about money. Now, clearly, I'm not talking about people in poverty, but middle class people who just care about other things. They sometimes are happier than really wealthy people. But I do think that, you know, not having to worry about money is a good freedom, and you can pursue other things and you don't have to worry about just making money.
Well, and that's something that I think a lot of us, a lot of the non fabulously rich think about is, oh, if I had $1 billion, I wouldn't do anything. I would just retire to an island and fritter the day away. But that clearly isn't your philosophy, and that clearly isn't what makes you happy.
Well, I agree. Look, what made me happiest was pleasing my mother. I would do something, and she actually said, you're doing something useful with your life. So my mother actually, you know, I think was happy. Making your parents happy is a nice thing to do. It's harder. It's easier to make your parents happy than to make your children happy, I would say. But I also say that look, someone once said, how much money does it take to make you feel financially secure? And the answer is exactly twice whatever you have. So if you have $1 billion, you feel I need to have $2 billion. If you have $10 billion, I need $20 billion. If you have $100,000, you need $200,000. So very few people really feel financially secure. I think, you know, maybe Bill Gates does, and maybe Elon Musk does, but most people probably don't.
I'll hop to one of your interviewees, Paul Simon. Who did I interview who wrote the book, who just came up with a book on Paul Simon interviews, Chris?
Oh. Malcolm Gladwell.
Yes, he has a book out with him, yes.
Yes, and I just did a long-form interview with him. I didn't want to say his name because I was worried because I attributed Freakonomics to him like everyone does. And now I'm scared to bring up Malcolm Gladwell's name because I think I'm going to screw it up somehow, which, by the way, he had a great attitude about it, which is good. Let people think I'm responsible for Freakonomics. But we got into some long form about Paul Simon, who just appears to be not only a great musician, but a great interview and storyteller as well. Do you have thoughts about that?
Look, Paul Simon had a great partnership with Art Garfunkel. It fell apart about 50 years ago or so. But, you know, Paul Simon turned out to be a great songwriter, one of the two or three best popular songwriters of our lifetime. I'd say he's up there with Paul McCartney as a great songwriter. Paul Simon is a person that, you know, I really like. I think he's tried to do some really good things in with his philanthropy. You know, he was at the Kennedy Center performing just a few weeks ago when they had the Kennedy Center honors there. Quite something.
I performed at the Kennedy Center as well in 2018, but it wasn't the
acoustic or full band.
What were you doing there?
I went world music. I was doing stand up there, but I wasn't in the main hall. I was in the 1,000-seater or the 1,300-seater. There's a Kennedy Center and then another one, right?
Well, they have
the annex.
Yeah. Well, they have three big arenas. There's the Eisenhower Theater. You might have been there. You probably were not in the Opera House, and you probably were not in the Concert Hall. But if it's 1,300 seat, it's the Eisenhower Theater.
Ooh la la.
I must have stayed at the Watergate Hotel.
Ooh la la.
Which was big part of my childhood.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in North Hollywood, California, so and I did perform at the Eisenhower Theater, and I couldn't even find these places on a map. And when I say on a map, I mean a labeled map, like with the names,
with directions
of the states,
Thomas Guide,
and the cities on it. I was that bad a reader, and I had no idea where these places were. But I'm a child of the '70s, and I'm lots of Watergate, Nixon talk, right? When I was growing up, I had kind of a hippie mom, and everyone was obsessed. You know, Trump isn't the first president to be really hated. They hated Nixon, like really, really, especially if you were sort of out in California and you had a little bit of a hippie vibe to you. They hated Nixon.
There's no doubt about it. He was very unpopular. But people forget he won re-election by winning I think 49 states. It was after that the Watergate thing really came undone for him. But he actually was extremely popular when he beat McGovern by 49 states to one, I think it was.
Wow.
It was kind of interesting because back then there was this whole we're moving from a fashion standpoint. Like I don't mean just clothing, but sort of haircut, aesthetic vibe. Some, you know, he was old school with the suits and the hair and stuff. He was your dad's friend.
Goddamn.
And we were going through Vietnam and the hippie movement and sideburns and stuff like that. And we were there was like a, it was an aesthetic we were moving from, you know? Yeah.
Yes. That was when the, the Vietnam produced the counterculture environment and the sexual revolution and the drug revolution and a whole bunch of other things that Nixon was against. And he obviously had enough people to support him. He also put a American flag on his lapel as if to say, I'm a patriot, I'm an American, and the other guy isn't. When ironically, George McGovern had been a combat pilot and risked his life many times. Nixon was in service, but he didn't really risk his life.
Yeah, Nixon crushed McGovern, but I was right smack dab in the middle of McGovern country living with my parents growing up out here. So is the key, Brian, you got a question?
I only speaking of controversial figures, maybe the answer is no and this goes nowhere. But given what you did for the last 30 plus years, did you know Bernie Madoff? And did you have some suspicion that something was awry?
Yeah, I actually never knew Bernie Madoff. And I felt when the whole thing unfolded, I said, geez, how come I never heard of him? How come I didn't know him? I mean, I didn't know anything about him. I since found out a lot of people who are friends of mine had invested with him. He just wasn't on my radar screen because of the kind of business deals I do. And it is amazing that now in hindsight, many people said they always thought something was wrong or they thought it was impossible to do what he did. But it's amazing he got away with it for so long. Amazing.
Is there a way to get sort of circling back to all the fundraising and that, you know, the Congress people and beyond, they spend half their time just raising money, which is kind of insane because you hire them to do a job, you elect them to do a job, and then half of it is just fundraising. Mm. They always talk about getting the money out of politics. Is there any way that we could go about doing that? I feel like it would help.
The only way you could do it is through a constitutional amendment, because the Supreme Court has essentially said that individuals can give all the money they want to their campaign. It's free speech and it's a matter of free speech for them. And for other people, there's no limit to how much corporations and others can give anymore. So you'd have to have a constitutional amendment. It's unlikely to happen. The reason they raise so much money are four reasons. One, if you raise a lot of money, you probably have a better chance of winning. People have more money in a campaign, usually win. Secondly, it scares away people to say how much money you have in the bank. So maybe somebody won't run against you. Third, you can use the money to give it to other members of Congress if you might want to help buy a committee chairmanship or subcommittee chairmanship. Giving money to other members often produces favors that are repaid. And fourth, when you retire from Congress, you can keep the money you have.
What?
What?
I didn't know that.
Yes. It used to be the case you can keep it and use it for personal purposes. Now you can use it for any political purpose. But for example, if you have $50 million in your political campaign, you can't buy a house with it, but you can use it for campaigns for the rest of your life to fund other people's campaigns or your campaign. And there's no limits on what you can do. If you say, for example, I'm going to hire my child to be my campaign advisor, it's not impossible to do that. So holding on to the money is something that you can do once you're defeated for office and you have extra money. Or you
Corolla for Congress.
Yeah.
Get my war chest.
I'd almost rather.
Yes.
I'd rather it be the other way around. Take it, go buy a house on a lake, but for God's sake, keep it out of, stop generating it if you're no longer in the game.
Well, think about this, for example. Right now, members of the Congress have not increased their salary for roughly 20 years. And as a result, something like 85 members of the House of Representatives don't have enough money to buy an apartment or rent an apartment in D.C., so they live in their offices. 85 members are living in their offices. So it's really bizarre. It's amazing we don't have more corruption because these guys have no money in many cases. Now, senators tend to be wealthier, and there are some wealthy members of the House, but younger people often don't have any money, and they have to live in their offices, which is supposedly against the law, but they do it anyway.
Doesn't it seem... There's going to be a space heater fire, predict.
Right.
Doesn't it seem like we don't want to amend the Constitution, but couldn't we put something forth that said when you leave, the money has to go to the March of Dimes? You can't
take your money with you? Yes, that can be done by legislation. But who has to pass that legislation?
Why would they vote against themselves?
Right.
I would like to buy beer for anyone who brought that up and wanted to push that bill across, because
I don't think that bill's going to get a lot of support anytime soon.
Yeah, but in a way where you could make it a bit of a cause celeb, you could get it out there, you could shame those who did not support the bill. Maybe now. I certainly years ago, I don't know if that could get any traction, but maybe now. Yes, Gina.
It's essentially the political giving pledge by Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, but for politics.
Yeah.
Well, so optically, it would look good.
It would, but members of Congress have to pass it. And it's very hard to get anything passed right now in Congress. For example, I was thinking the other day, if the 1964 Civil Rights Act came up in front of Congress today, it wouldn't pass the Senate.
Really?
No way. I'm not even sure the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments of the Constitution would pass.
Wow.
Because, you know, some people are just going to vote against anything because they're afraid their constituents will think it's not appropriate. So it's hard to believe that we actually got some of this legislation passed in the 1960s or so.
Yeah, I had this comedy bit that I've never really done, but I've said it on stage, which is I feel like the American people have to look at Congress as their mom and their dad. And on behalf of the kids, who are us, the American people, you guys need to stop fighting so much. You're ruining.
Get together on this. You
you're
don't
ruining
like
our childhood. Yeah. Like I get, and I think if you take it and you translate it into a family situation, there are many, many families where the mom and the dad are having friction in their marriage. Maybe it's loveless. Maybe there's affairs. God knows what. But we're keeping it together on behalf of the children. You've heard that a lot. I've heard about a lot of couples that stay together until the kid goes off to college. And then they get divorced. You know, but on behalf of the kids. You know what I mean? Let's not show. It's traumatizing to the kids to see you guys screaming at each other in the kitchen all day. It freaks the kids out. And I feel like in this equation, we're the kids. And those are the parents, and we get it. The love is gone, and you don't like each other.
Emotions.
And you all have a guma on the side. But for the sake of the kids and the health of the family, could we just have a pretense of getting along?
You know, it'd be nice, but I don't think it's going to happen. some people have proposed that unless members of Congress are supposed to pass 13 appropriation bills every year, they ultimately don't do that. They just have one continuing resolution now. But you could say, unless you pass the appropriation bills on time, you don't get paid your salary. Now, unfortunately, a lot of members of Congress probably would not be affected by that because they're so wealthy. But if you could figure out some way that members of Congress have to do something on time or there's some penalty for them, that would be good. But it's unrealistic. It's not going to happen.
Well, I think the only one that affects everyone equally is when there's fighting. Oh, wait, we have to break for Christmas. Oh, no, you don't. You sit in that room until you figure it out. There will be no Christmas break for you.
Well, they have the continuing resolution where you just pass things for another couple months or so. Or the, you know, it's a different. It used to be the case that lots of legislation occurred during the year and you had committee hearings, subcommittee hearings. That usually doesn't happen now. Almost everything is done in the leadership office with the leaders in the House and the Senate. They work everything out. There really aren't a lot of people who are paying attention to what the subcommittees and committees are doing that much. Maybe a little bit on the appropriation side, but Congress isn't passing major bills anymore.
You know, when you said it wasn't going to happen, you know, it always strikes me like I like things to be run like a business, just more efficient. And I'm picturing a business where you'd say, like, well, really, what would fix this whole shipping and receiving thing is if we move the conveyor belt closer to the roll-up door where the trucks pull in. But that's never going to happen. And then you just kept talking about things that would work and would make more efficient work. And then you pause and go, but that's never going to happen. And it's like, could you imagine bringing that into a business setting?
Well, you know, at some point, everybody has to decide what is worth spending your time on, what's going to be productive and what isn't going to be worth spending your time on. And if you say, I'm going to try to fix Congress, you can maybe try to do it, but at some point you're beating your head
against the wall. That's never
going to happen. And try to do something else with your life that's more productive.
I concur. David Rubenstein, the book is called The American Experiment, Dialogues on a Dream. Available now on Amazon and many interesting, notable people. And, of course, he's got a podcast, For the Ages, a history podcast, and you can check that out as well. David, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. Good luck. Okay?
We'll take it.
Bye.
All right. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and do the news right after this.
Give me the news with Grad. News with Gino Grad. Breaking viral. Weird crime, protest, politics. Give me news with Gino Grad. Stuff they saw on TMZ. Joe Biden. Kamala. Meet news with Gina. Gina Grad.
News with Gina Grad.
The first man to receive a heart transplant from a pig is alive and has the beating heart inside of his chest. The procedure using a genetically altered pig was done at the University of Maryland Medical Center. The man who volunteered for the experimental surgery, is 57-year-old Dave Bennett. Doctors are hopeful the procedure will lead to to other organ transplants from animals that can save human lives. I smell a sci-fi hit on our hands.
Yeah, or a Jim Carrey-esque, you know, comedy movie called BLT or something. We'd work it out. We'd work out the initials to something other than BLT, but he got that.
Bacon, lettuce, and togetherness.
Yeah, like you have to start then taking on, you know, start rooting for pig truffles qualities, and things like that. That's right. What I know.
Right.
Yeah, well, good.
But I mean, and you think about when you were talking about Paul Simon, you think of the song, you know, the boy in the bubble and the baby with the baboon heart. Mm-hmm. We've done this, but this, every time it happens, it's newsworthy, and I think for a reason.
Are we beyond the part where, like, the Christian community gets outraged because you're playing God sort of thing? Because back in the day, there would have been some of that. Some group would be outraged.
I am on more than one far-right Christian mailing list, and I'll let you know over the next couple of days. Yeah. Right, that I get outraged emails every boycott the NFL, boycott this, boycott
really?
That. Yes.
How do you get on these lists?
I actually don't. I suspect. So, okay, long story, I'm like as short as possible. BrianBishop.com used to be owned by a Southern preacher named Brian Bishop.
Oh.
I think his wife signed up for a lot of emails under the website.
I'm wondering how you know all this stuff, because I never get anything.
And I just don't want to subscribe. I just get the email. I got one yesterday. I said, boycott the NFL. They have a bunch of pornographers performing at halftime of the Super Bowl. It's Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg.
Oh.
Yeah, so
the Dallas Cowboy cheerleader.
Why are these the biggest snowflakes of all? These right wing religious nuts. Boycott
but
this.
I can't have this. I think these mailing lists has gotten to you because I think you're like my sister worked at the hair salon in Silver Lake. You think 80% of population is gay?
No. Yeah, yeah. I recognize
I'm like,
it's a small fraction.
I've never even heard of this. But
I'll look up a few.
All right. See if they're outraged.
Deleted email.
See if they're outraged.
Well, while you're doing that, American Idol favorite and friend of the show, Clay Aiken, didn't plan to run for Congress a second time, but then he heard his home state's lieutenant governor bash the LGBTQ community, and he is back in, baby. Clay, who is a Democrat who was defeated when he ran for a different North Carolina seat back in 2014, he had this to say to Variety. He said he'd moved on from politics until last fall, and he's 43 now. He said, in November, the lieutenant governor here in North Carolina, Mark Robinson, gave a speech in which he said, what is the purpose of homosexuality? What purpose do homosexuals serve? I watch that sort of thing with just dumbstruck awe that someone could be so ignorant. After watching it, I said, you know what? I got your purpose, bitch. I'll show you.
Oh, he stands, I want to be, you know, I'm going to add this to my list of things to do, which is I wanted nothing to do with politics.
Right.
And then I turned on the news and I saw this and I had to do something.
Yes.
I want that on my list of things that I've done.
I think that's very achievable for you.
I had to make a move.
Yeah.
Clay sent me a text yesterday. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he did.
And we should talk to him.
He said, can you retweet this or something?
Well,
and then I did. And then I said, well, why don't you come on? And he said, fine, or soon, or something.
He was so lovely last time he was on. I think it was this time last year when we were all at home. Here's why he has a better chance at winning this time. Because 8 years ago, he ran in a very rural Republican district. And this time, he's running in a very Democratic area where the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Duke University is. So, you know, it's a different vibe.
DeJarris Mandering. He's a wideout for LSU. Add that to the list, Max Zapata. DeJarris Mandering. Although Chris didn't get it.
No, I said yes, I'll add.
You could just call him Jerry, right?
Yeah.
DeJerry.
Yeah, but it's too on the nose. I'll go DeJarris Mandering. He had a blank look, that's all. I didn't know how to read you.
Oh, no.
We're playing poker over here?
I'm
producing
a
show. I think we're ready. I don't know. Is he North Carolina or South? I think they're ready. Maybe they're ready for a gay man, but not a redhead. Sorry, Clay.
That's
too much.
I'm pretty open-minded. I could definitely get behind a gay candidate, but Ginger, Rusty.
Can't be done.
Better luck next time.
I'm not that evolved. You know what I mean?
Well, you know what's funny about that ways. Is, yeah, no, I get it. Adam's Adam. But there was an interview recently with Ed Sheeran saying that South Park ruined his life. Because think about it. Before the South Park episode of like the gingers and the gingers walk among us and they're the daywalkers, Americans had no thoughts about redheads. You know, like when the Spice Girls came around, we weren't sure at first what ginger spice meant.
Oh, well,
like,
I thought she was spicy.
No thoughts.
Yeah. No, yeah. I never. Right.
So now we have thoughts about something that he was like, I would come to the United States and people be like, oh, cool hair, man. And then South Park, that episode, like leveled him.
Well, let's be clear. We've always been pretty good. Going back to Gilligan's Island, Ginger and Marianne. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Ginger. Right.
Good point.
We're very good with the ladies. Not with Rusty. Not with Danny Bonaducci. Not with the dudes. We cut the women wide swath. We do not beaten like a redheaded stepchild.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You're right.
That stepchild's a dude.
Even in The Outsiders, the super hot girl, I think Diane Lane played her in the movie, Cherry. They called her Cherry because she had red hair, and we loved her.
We're all about the ladies. It's the guys that really take the pummeling. Now,
you're right.
That's the Clay Aiken problem. I don't think they're ready for a redhead.
Well, hopefully he gets a dye job because that would be very interesting. Mm-hmm. And he's not, I mean, I really don't remember where he stands politically, but something tells me he wouldn't run on like a super radical left platform.
He's a hard-working MF-er, man.
Yeah, I think he'd be like pretty down the middle in many ways.
I did that Celebrity Apprentice with him, and I was blown away at how hard that guy worked. Because you go in with these pre-notions, you know? You go Clay Aiken and American Idol, gay guy, redhead. And then there's Lou Ferrigno over here.
Beefy.
Man's Hulk.
Yeah, all-American.
And lives in, he's a gym rat.
Red-blooded American.
Hitch your wagon to that star.
Turns out Clay Aiken, much harder worker than Lou Ferrigno.
Well, we should have him back on. I think he's a really interesting guy.
Yeah, I agree. Oh, I sent him he sent me text. I sent him a text and told him to come on. So he will.
Great. Mm-hmm. Well, we have lost a hero, and I'm not being facetious, though it'll sound like I am when I tell you who the hero is. We have spoken about this hero before a long time ago, but he is now deceased. Magua. He was the hero rat whose work sniffing out landmines in Cambodia won him a medal for life-saving bravery. He's died at the age of 8. CNN, look at that little guy. CNN reports that the African giant pouched rat found more than 100 landmines and other explosives during his service in this mine clearing organization. His work saw him win a gold medal from the British veterinary charity, the People's Dispensary for Sick Animals, in 2020. Magawa, who retired last year, is the most successful hero rat to date, and he will be missed. Look at him on a little leash. Out landmines.
Did a lot more than fucking Princess Di did finding those landmines.
She brought attention to
Magawa. Yeah, she did a photo op, but then the rats came in and did the heavy lifting.
But they have him on like a little, what looks like a retractable, you know, zip line sort of wire leash. Mm. And he's out there sniffing around. Now, you know, if dogs and crows can be trained, look at this little guy.
Look, I love it. I want to train my crows. I love it when we get a little. And also, let's be honest. You get the guy out there with the poker stick and a human could lose a leg.
Right.
Rat blows up on top of a landmine and you're there. That's the coolest day of your life. I mean, in terms of witnessing something, seeing a giant rat step on a landmine.
You'll be telling
up
your grandkids about that.
That's a visual, man.
Yeah.
That's better than an M80 in a mailbox.
Significantly. Right.
Significantly.
Yeah, it's a win-win.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Except for little Magawa.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's move on to some sports news.
Has Brian's boycott the NFL email.
Oh, yeah. Pornographers at the halftime show. This is one of four or five I get a week.
Wow.
Well, this one's addressed to Mrs. Amelia Bishop.
Oh, good.
This is shocking. The National Football League.
It's always all caps or exclamations or something shocking.
The National Football League, parenthetically NFL, will promote, quote, vocal pornographers at the Super Bowl halftime show.
Damn right.
Controversial rappers Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg are scheduled to perform with other rappers. Both have been described as lyric pornographers for their works, graphically describing violent and immoral acts, in addition to racial and anarchic content. I guess it's a word.
I guess.
While we don't know what they will be performing, we do know that they have sung songs glorifying rape and violence. It is undeniable that these singers should not be featured for the country's most watched sporting events.
I heard Dr. Dre was paying for it. Now, I don't know how that worked, but I was watching TMZ and they were talking about how he's paying for it out of his own pocket. They didn't get into a lot of details. Sounds weird. And that if the NFL, you know, moved the venue or canceled the show or whatever it is, he would be holding the bag. But
oh boy.
I don't know what it was based on. It's TMZ, but they do have a bunch of lawyers in the room. They don't make stuff up out of whole cloth. And I don't know where. I was kind of confused because it's like, you know, Celine Dion wouldn't pay to perform at the halftime show. Right. But there's got to be something to it.
Do you think it's some situation where he bought an ad and thus, you know, got to play the half? If we see Beats by Dre ad during the Super Bowl, then maybe there's some, you know, help us help you.
I don't know, but Chris will find it out.
So according to TMZ, Dre could lose millions of dollars because sources with direct knowledge tell them that Dre is fronting most of the money necessary to pull off the event with all the guest stars, and we're told it's in the millions of dollars. Dre does have event cancellation insurance to cover any calamity that might derail the halftime show. Problem is, we're told there's an exclusion for COVID.
Oh boy.
It's the only reason you get it.
What is this precedent, though, where he's underwriting this thing?
I've never heard
of this before. It seems bizarre. Like when the black guy pees
in L.A.
got a four wallet. There. Well, but like when the Black Eyed Peas performed, they didn't have to pony up a bunch of cash, did they?
Is there a situation, I'll throw it out there, like where they're like, we'll give you $1 million. You're like, all right, so he's going to spend $3 million to get this production to where he wants Snoop and the lights and you know what I mean?
Yeah, the NFL must have a budget. And then he must be going, I want to do a lot more than that.
Yeah, that's what I think it is.
Is that what's going on?
That's what it's looking like. It's just,
but to the tune of millions of dollars. And by the way, I miss the days when calamities would happen versus, you know, mass shootings and diseases and things. I miss an old-fashioned calamity. Yeah. I'm due for a nice calamity. It's like the pickpocket.
According
The
Weeknd reportedly spent $7 million on his halftime performance last year.
The Weeknd did?
Yeah.
Wow.
What?
I guess.
I think it's according to Billboard.
So I guess, you know, I guess you go, I want 700 dancers and a whole bunch of those light up twizzle sticks that everyone waves over their head. And then the NFL goes, we got enough for 35 twizzle sticks and 18 dancers. And then you go, I want 500 dancers and 1,000 twizzle sticks. And they go, well, you cut the check. But what in a world where people spend $4.7 million for a 30-second ad, and you're doing a 8-minute ad for yourself, you know.
It's a bargain. Yeah.
I think that's kind of the way they look at it.
Yeah, most articles are actually saying they invested millions of dollars to their for their performance. And The Weeknd, his streams of his songs rose 69% after he headlined the Super Bowl.
Yeah, it did.
There you go.
All right, let's do one more, Gina Grad.
One more. Okay, well, you know what? Then let's pay homage to another fallen hero. Brian, I want you to pay special attention here.
Oh, no.
The world of professional wrestling is mourning the loss of an icon. Her name was Deanna Boer. That might not mean anything to you. However, Matilda the Hun and Queen Kong might mean something to you.
Yeah.
She passed away last Friday at the age of 73, 6'3", 315 pounds. She was a mud wrestler, amateur mud wrestler, before moving on to GLOW, Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, in the mid-80s. I remember her vividly.
Big gal.
I'm sure Brian does as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Must have been tough to have been fat in the 80s. You walk into Vince McMahon's office and he's like, I got just the idea.
Yeah.
Well, King Kong, or what was her name? Queen Kong?
Queen Kong, yeah. And Matilda the Hun.
It's got to, I mean, I'm sure she'd trade all the riches and all the championship belts and all the first class travel away just to be a 120-pound chick who worked at a Dairy Queen in the Midwest, right?
You'd think so.
Because there were some gorgeous ladies of wrestling. But then, you know, it's like, are you one of the cutesy girls or are you Matilda the Hun? There were only two categories.
Is she,
like you say about porn.
Yes. Has she joined the fabulous Moolah in heaven?
Moolah passed some time ago.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I'm surprised she made it this far with her carriage. Yeah.
Although, and the physical abuse.
Yes. Although.
On herself.
There are.
I met her husband.
It's like the NFL. It's like the NFL. How surreal was that watching Rue McClanahan get beat
horrible.
Up on by Dick Van Patten? There is another side, which happens with a lot of NFL interior linemen, some I've spoken to, which is they're playing at 320 pounds, and then all of a sudden they've been retired for 4 years and they're 235 and they're doing a plant-based diet.
The Mark Schlereth of the world.
They go the other direction. Yep. They actually get healthier. So I don't know if she did, but she's definitely going to be missed. I don't know what the state of female wrestling is today. Male wrestling,
female wrestling's bigger than ever.
Some say
bigger than the men.
Really?
Yes, but it's not separate. Like female wrestlers can be in the WWE. You know, it's not like the gorgeous ladies of wrestling.
Yeah, they'll
their
do
own
men's
thing.
Match, right. Women's match.
I see all these big matches. WrestleMania is as big as it ever was, probably. I don't know. I see a lot of commercials for
it. Bella sisters.
Yeah, they're huge celebrities.
It's interesting that, and it was sort of like when people were talking about the day the home VCRs released. Not the commercial grade one that Elvis had, but as soon as a consumer base,
Sony made one for $150.
$150. That every movie theater will be closed in the next year. They'll be out of business.
Yep.
They'll spell the end of and here we are with reclining, massaging seats and beautiful 4G or whatever
four K
and
full and dinner service.
All the things. So look, they didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
But you thought, as soon as the UFC really takes hold, like as soon as there's actual combat, like men
wrestling for real,
man and woman, this is it, man. They're in a cage. This every day is a cage match, and they're really going at it. Well, that'll be the day the professional wrestling goes away.
Not
so much. Interesting. All right, let's bring it home, Gina Grad.
You got it. I'm Gina Grad, and that's the news. Eat dirt and die trash. Gina.
That was the news with Gina Grad.
Well, let me tell you about CBDX. When CBD came out, we all wanted it to be like cannabis, and it wasn't. It helps, but you didn't exactly feel it. CBDX.com, Delta 8 THC, a federally legal form of THC, and you will absolutely feel it. Flower that's just like the cannabis, you know, strong but discreet vape cartridges, certainly potent gummies, and even pure concentrates. These will get you stoned, people, and it will show up as THC on a drug test, so be forewarned. Never drive or operate heavy machinery when you're on these products, and you can learn more. Go to CBDX.com. That is four letters, CBDX, and use the code ADAM. Get 20% off and a free gift when you go to CBDX.com. All right. You can check out me and Bill Shatner and Dennis Quaid doing a couple of shows over there coming up. Brea Improv, February 8th. Is it the 8th?
No, it's the 6th.
That's what I'm thinking. Why does it say the 8th?
I don't know.
Well, I think that about sums it up. You can also check out Truth Yeller, my two specials. I think there are going to be four up there up at the Daily Wire if you like. I want to thank David Rubenstein, The American Experiment, name of the book. You can check that out. And you can go down to Parole.com and check out what we got for you. And until next time, it's Adam Carolla for Gina Grad and Bull Bryan and David Rubenstein saying mahalo.
Drink piss to own the libs.
You can catch this episode of the Adam Carolla Show on video at youtube.com/Adam Carolla. Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. And get your tickets to see the Ace Man in Brea, Truth Yeller, Dennis Quaid, William Shatner. Get them now on the World Wide Web at AdamCarolla.com.
Hey, Geico, do you own? Do you rent? Well, you do one or the other, right? You know. It's hard work out there, owning, renting. You want to save some money? How about you bundle your policies at Geico? Geico makes it easy to bundle the homeowners or renters insurance along with your auto policy. It's a good thing too because you got so much to do already. Go to geico.com, get a quote, see just how much you could save at Geico. That is geico.com today. That's geico.com.